We welcome everyone to today's hearing on the report of Special Counsel Robert Herr. Mr. Herr, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Members of the committee, good morning.
When Special Counsel Robert Herr agreed to investigate President Biden for mishandling classified documents, he knew that his final decision would upset some faction within American politics.
My respect for the Justice Department and my commitment to this country are why I agreed to serve as special counsel when asked by the Attorney General.
But as he testified before Congress last week, it was clear that both parties now have a bone to pick with him.
And I am desperately afraid that this decision of the Department of Justice is now crossed a very bright line.
You made a choice that was a political choice. It was the wrong choice.
It's an awkward situation. Both Biden and Donald Trump have been investigated for mishandling classified documents. Trump is facing a series of felony counts for the matter, while Biden won't face any.
The long-awaited report by Special Counsel Robert Herr concludes that no criminal charges against President Biden are warranted.
But Biden isn't exactly celebrating, because Herr's report, while vindicating Biden, also referred to him as a, quote, elderly man with a poor memory.
My memory is not good. My memory is fine.
Biden and his supporters have condemned these statements, calling them unnecessary, inflammatory, and prejudicial.
The way that the president's demeanor in that report was characterized could not be more wrong on the facts and clearly politically motivated.
After the report was published last month, my colleague Andrew Morantz and I discussed it on this show, mostly in the context of the Democrats' frustration. But recently, our colleague Jeannie Suk Gerson was able to get an exclusive interview with Robert Herr himself. And after talking to him and having thoroughly reviewed his work, she's here to offer her analysis of the report and on what she believes to be Herr's real motivations.
I think the forgetfulness is being misunderstood as kind of a side dig and a politically motivated attack.
Jeannie is also a professor at Harvard Law School, and so I got to talk to her a little bit about the state of the Trump trials. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. I'm wondering if we can start just by sort of walking through the origins of the classified documents investigations into both Biden and Trump and how they're, you know, connected and how they're different.
Yeah. So the classified documents case against Donald Trump began in 2022 when the FBI was trying to get documents back from him, and he resisted giving these documents back because, as it turned out, in January 2021, Trump and his staff had stuffed a whole bunch of papers into many boxes, and they went to Mar-a-Lago, and according to the indictment, they were kept in various rooms of Mar-a-Lago, including a ballroom, a bathroom and a shower, and a storage room that was accessible from a pool patio. And essentially, they were just stored in completely inappropriate places. And the Justice Department opened a criminal investigation. And then with a subpoena, it demanded the return of all these documents. And finally, in August of 22, there was an FBI search that recovered more than 100 additional classified documents, and that's how it began. In June of 2023, there was a felony indictment based on the retention of national defense information about top secret intelligence, about foreign countries and foreign military nuclear capabilities, and he was really hurt in this indictment by the fact that he had resisted so much having these documents retrieved by the federal government, that he didn't just simply return them when he was asked to return them.
Yeah, it wasn't just like, I didn't realize I had these, I'll give them back. It was he held on to them.
Yes, that he not only held on to them, but there was evidence, at least according to the indictment, that he had his staff move them around so that they wouldn't necessarily be detectable by the government, and he made many efforts to try to keep them even when the government wanted them. So that's a really big fact about the Trump indictment that doesn't exist in the Biden indictment, in that in the fall of 2022, when Biden's lawyers reported that classified documents had been found at his home. Then he readily returned them and submitted to an FBI search, which found some more documents. And then from that point on, he cooperated fully with the investigation. And there's no claim here that Biden resisted returning the documents or resisted any searches or resisted detection of any of these documents.
So then why did the Biden thing continue? I mean, is it just because he, even though he gave the documents back, he still had them and there needed to be an investigation into why?
Well, it's because there are two issues here. One is obstruction of justice, which is about trying to obstruct the government's discovery of the documents and investigation. It's very clear from the indictment that Trump engaged in behaviors that are alleged to have been obstruction of justice. And Biden didn't do that. And there's no claim here that he did that. Then there's the underlying crime, which is the retention of national defense documents that one is not authorized to have. And according to the crime that we're talking about here, which is a part of the Espionage Act, you have to have retained these classified documents, knowing that it's unauthorized for you to have them, and to have done so willfully. Willfully is the key term.
So is that what's being investigated with Biden, how willful it was?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because it was not really disputed that he had these documents, which you're not supposed to have, and that it was unauthorized for him to have them. And since it was after he left the vice presidency in 2017, it is very clear that he was not authorized to have classified documents in his home or his offices. And so then the idea was, did he do this completely accidentally? Which you can imagine that a former vice president would end up with some classified documents not knowing that he had them and not intending to keep them. That was altogether possible. But the investigation turned up evidence that he did know that he had these documents in 2017. And in fact, there was an audio recording that was part of the investigative record that Robert Hur considered, which was that he said to the ghostwriter of his memoir back in 2017, words to the effect of, "I just found all the classified stuff downstairs." So that statement, it's hard to get around the meaning of that statement, which is that he knew
I found the stuff. Now I can tell you about it for the book that you're ghostwriting. I mean, that's kind of
that does
right?
seem like yes. That does seem like what the reason that you would be telling your ghostwriter about classified documents and having found them is because you're about to say something about them. And in fact, the recordings do include Joe Biden reading classified information aloud from his notebook, which contained classified material, on at least three occasions. That he read it aloud to his ghostwriter, and that's also on tape. So given that investigation and that evidence, there was a real case here of whether Biden retained classified documents willfully as opposed to accidentally.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the decision to appoint a special counsel for each of these cases. Like when we think about the mishandling of classified documents, it seems like that's something that the FBI would look into.
Yeah, the ordinary channels of federal investigation leading to a criminal indictment would be handled by the FBI and then the regular Justice Department criminal prosecutors. But there is this uncomfortable situation where the investigation is of high executive branch officials, and you can't get any higher than the President of the United States. So the Justice Department and the FBI are all under the control of the President of the United States in that he is the head of the entire branch of government, and they answer to him ultimately. And how do you investigate your boss and how do you prosecute your own boss when your boss is the one who's supposed to be directing you and supervising you at the end of the day, especially when the boss could fire you and has hired you? We saw this in the Nixon era when President Nixon fired the special prosecutor who was investigating the Watergate burglary and subpoenaed President Nixon for White House tapes that he had that would incriminate him. And Nixon had this special prosecutor fired and replaced him with someone else that he thought would be more friendly to him. Well, that turned out, of course, not to be the case.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it really vividly illustrated the problem. And so over the decades, there have been several different kinds of solutions. But this current era, which began in around 1999 after the Bill Clinton impeachment, is one where we don't have any congressional statute in place that provides for a particular independent counsel. All we have right now are Justice Department regulations that say that in cases where it would be in the public interest to have an outside special counsel instead of a regular federal prosecutor from the Justice Department, then the Justice Department, in the form of the Attorney General, can appoint a special counsel. So it's really entirely up to the Attorney General whether to appoint a special counsel, and the special counsel answers to the Attorney General. And yes, at the end of the day, the Attorney General still answers to the president. So we haven't really gotten rid of the ultimate problem of this conflict of interest. But at the same time, there's a Justice Department understanding that that special counsel will be given a bunch of independence so that he can conduct the investigation even into the president of the United States without feeling interfered with or that he could be fired for trying to uncover the president's alleged criminality.
Jeannie, I want to ask you a bit more about the report itself and what you thought of Hur's ultimate findings, but first we have to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment. If you like the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. And while you're there, don't forget to hit the follow button so you never miss an episode.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So Hur began his investigation into Biden over a year ago. And this past February, he submitted a final report saying that the investigation, quote, uncovered evidence that President Biden willfully retained and disclosed classified materials after his vice presidency. With this evidence, including what you mentioned earlier, this recording of Biden telling the ghostwriter, I found the classified stuff. But Hur decided not to prosecute Biden. He basically said in his report that based on his interviews with the president, he thought that if the case were to go to trial, Biden's defense would successfully present Biden as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, which would stop a jury from deciding to convict him. Biden's supporters have pointed out that Hur's a Republican. They've claimed that Hur's decision to include these things in the report about Biden's memory, that that was politically motivated. The White House, too, called them unnecessary, inflammatory, and prejudicial statements that weren't part of the special counsel's job to make. You spoke with Hur. What was his response to the uproar and the idea that the stuff that he said about Biden's memory was out of bounds?
Well, when I did interview Robert Hur, he did avoid himself giving a gloss on the report and really preferred to just point to the words of the report and the report itself. And so really all of my analysis of the actual decision that Hur made in the special counsel investigation comes from this 345-page report and reading it very closely, if that makes sense.
I guess what would you say, like, you know, your analysis is then for why he included these things?
Well, as I read the report and understand the evidence against President Biden, you've got the element of retention of classified materials. That one is clear, that he did retain classified materials. It's very clear from the evidence that he knew they were classified, at least in 2017, when he said, I found the classified stuff downstairs. It's also clear from the recording that he shared the classified information to some degree with his ghostwriter. So that's a no-no. And so then it's a matter of how willful was it? Was it willful? Well, it seems willful if you have a recording basically saying that. So then the question is, how do you not charge? How do you not indict given that all those things are satisfied. Well, that's where Herr said, I'm going to decline to recommend prosecution anyway, because I can consider some defenses that I predict that Biden is going to raise. And he knew that from interviewing Biden and from doing the investigation, talking to lots of people. He knew the defenses that would be raised. And the defenses, the core of them, was that Biden forgot he had the documents and forgot that they were classified. This is what Biden said. And so the question is, does the prosecutorial team, does Herr believe that? And ultimately, the question of whether Herr believes it is secondary to whether the ultimate decision maker, which here might be a trial jury, is going to believe it. So what a prosecutor is doing is trying to project into the future, thinking about a trial jury and what they're going to be inclined to think about these actions. And so when he says something like, I mean, these are his exact words in the report, the evidence does not establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, what that means is the decision maker, a jury, is not going to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so there's the initial question of, did he in fact retain classified documents that he wasn't supposed to retain? And did he do so knowing that they were classified? And then a question that is separate and yet completely inseparable, which is, will the ultimate decision maker go for it and convict this man beyond a reasonable doubt? So what's a reasonable doubt? It's just a sliver of doubt that makes you think, it's reasonable that maybe this alternative explanation is possible. That reasonable doubt was Joe Biden having forgotten. And so the forgetfulness was entirely integral to the evidence in this case, given that that is what Biden would say. And so when Herr says these fateful 10 words that he would come across as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, that is not about making some neurological or extraneous observation that was intended to diss Biden, although maybe it had the effect of being insulting. The idea was that this is what he would come across like to a jury, because in part, the defense attorneys would be trying to make that impression on the jury so that the jury would think, oh, he had these documents, not willfully, but forgetfully, absentmindedly, unintentionally. And even if there was a moment where it's certain as could be, when you have something on tape, that he had the documents, he knew he had the documents, and he shared the material in them with someone he wasn't supposed to. How do you get around that? Well, you get around that by saying he forgot. So I think the forgetfulness is being misunderstood as kind of a side dig and an insult and a politically motivated attack. But at the same time, if you're looking at it as a prosecutor or a trial attorney trying to make a prediction about whether this man would be convicted by a jury, well, it only takes one juror to have reasonable doubt. And is it predictable that one jury might think, I think actually he did forget because he's pretty old and, you know, he's in his 80s. At the time, he would be well into his 80s and he would present in front of a jury as someone who could have forgotten. And I think that that is ultimately very core, not extraneous to the evidence and the case that Herr was looking at.
Maybe this is just revealing my lack of understanding about what a special counsel does. But when I hear that the memory issues were brought up as something that would affect a jury's perception of the case, I immediately think this seems like we're, you know, fast forwarding. Like, isn't the job to find the evidence, put it down, and then recommend charges based on the amount of evidence that you were yourself were able to find, and then, you know, worry about how to make that argument to a jury down the line? Like, why is it the kind of thing that would be crucial, like a special counsel report?
That's really interesting, Tyler, because I think a special counsel, the role may have some variety to it in the way the public has experienced it. So we lived through the Mueller special counsel investigation and report regarding then President Trump's behavior. And that report was interesting in that it didn't necessarily do this. It didn't project forward thinking about a jury and what a jury would think. It did pretty much what you just described, which is lay out all the facts. And one of the things that I personally found, and many people found, very frustrating about Mueller's report is that he didn't even come to a recommendation about whether to prosecute. He declined to do one or the other. Rob Hur's report is different in that it goes through all the steps to the end in the way that a regular prosecutor would do. Memos about criminal cases are written all the time, day in and day out, by federal prosecutors who lay out the evidence and then make a recommendation. And a prosecutor normally takes all of that into account in deciding whether to even indict someone. So I think that lots of people think that everyone is held to the same legal standard, and that is true in a sense, that you have the same law that applies to everyone. But because everyone is different in all kinds of ways, some people are sympathetic characters, some people are unsympathetic characters, some people are unsavory people. You have to take all of that into account in terms of whether you're going to pour resources into prosecuting someone. And when you've got the president of the United States, who I think the report said a jury is going to want to find reasonable doubt in a case like this, you have to sort of take that into account. And when I say you have to, I don't mean literally you have to, but those are good federal prosecutorial principles that you wouldn't go ahead and indict someone if you think there's a very small chance that ultimately it's going to result in conviction. And here, I think Hur was kind of being transparent in showing his work, as he put it, that it's not just about whether the elements are met. It's really about whether ultimately the evidence at trial, which includes the defenses, would result in a jury unanimously saying, yes, we're going to convict him.
It's interesting that I feel like most people are used to the Mueller report, which was just like a list of findings and no actual conclusion. And so I think that seeing something that is just so specifically tailored toward the actual legal case and its viability and whether charges should be recommended, it's almost strange to see a document like that.
Yeah. And to me, that's so interesting because the Mueller report, to me, was the anomaly in that if you have a special counsel and he's been given all of these resources to investigate, and it's taken all of these months, and at the end of the day, to have him just do a several hundred page report that doesn't even ultimately use his judgment to say, we are the ones who know the evidence, we're the ones who interviewed all the people and looked at it and pored over it, and we're not even going to say what we recommend one way or another, we're going to leave it entirely in the attorney general's hands. Well, that's what he did. And Attorney General Barr made the call and made it really clear in his remarks what his take on it was. Here, I think Robert Hur did something that was more normal for federal prosecutors, which is that when they do an investigation, they're writing a memo about declining to bring charges, which is what this was. Ultimately, it's a special counsel report, but really it's just a fancy version of a declination memo that federal prosecutors write every day, where they decline to bring charges, and they explain it to the supervisor. And here, the supervisor is the Attorney General of the United States. And he is, in the report, explaining to the Attorney General why he does not recommend bringing charges. And it's so funny that that would strike us as strange. And we get that because the Mueller report is what we are so familiar with. But this is really the more ordinary thing for a federal prosecutor to be doing.
I want to go back to something you just said, which is that his audience was Attorney General Merrick Garland. And it's weird because at the same time, I mean, this was a report that everyone knew would be public from the start. And, you know, you mentioned in your piece that there's probably a way in which Hur could have basically said the exact same thing, but framed it in a way that just kind of made it clearer to the public that, you know, some of the stuff that he was saying about Biden's memory wasn't just kind of like a random character assassination. Like even this sentence, you know, the evidence does not establish Mr. Biden's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Like I read that and I immediately think, oh, so he like couldn't find enough evidence to, move forward. You know, I don't necessarily read that immediately as like, oh, he's thinking about like the way that a jury would not decide to convict Biden because they can't convict him, you know, based on the evidence, which proves that, you know, without a reasonable doubt, he did it. They're weird conflations and I guess things that Garland would understand, but like I wouldn't necessarily understand when reading this. And I guess I'm just curious whether you think that in the same way that part of her job was kind of looking ahead to how a jury might perceive Biden, if part of a special counsel's job when they're writing a public report is also looking ahead to how the public might perceive the findings in this report.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Tyler. I myself suggested to Robert Herr that he could have written the report differently in order to avoid some public misunderstanding about the report, just as you laid out. If I were on his team of prosecutors, that's what I would have advised him, to write it out more kind of, I guess, pedantically. And I think that Herr could have done it that way. But the point that he made to me on the record was that he didn't write it for the lay public and he didn't write it for even Congress, because the report, the assignment he received was narrowly to write this report for the Attorney General of the United States. And as he pointed out, he himself is an experienced prosecutor and would know exactly what that meant. So he was aware, of course, Herr was aware that the Attorney General had said he would make as much of the report public as would be appropriate. But I think that Herr really took the assignment to heart. He wasn't thinking, I'm writing this to the American public, even though I am special counsel. And that's a kind of very, I don't know, orthodox approach to federal prosecution, that he's really thinking, I am just a prosecutor doing an investigation, even if this is the president of the United States, and even if this is a special counsel position, I am really just investigating the way I normally would and making a declination decision the way I normally would. And so he says to me on the record that he wrote it just for the Attorney General of the United States. That was his audience. There is no reason to think the Attorney General had any misunderstanding. And in fact, the Justice Department wrote back to the White House when it complained, just saying very simply, he followed all of the Department of Justice policies. You know, the Department of Justice pushed back on the White House, which had accused him of violating department policies by essentially, like, you know, denigrating him, with no law enforcement purpose. But of course, the position of Herr is that it had a law enforcement purpose because it went to specifically whether there was enough evidence to bring charges. And I think that to me, it's very clear that Garland would have understood what Herr was doing, even if, say, the American public and Congress and Democrats and Republicans, basically everyone, really thought of it as two separate issues. Is there enough evidence? And is Biden a sympathetic elderly man with a poor memory? They're not two issues. They're the same issue.
Jeannie, I want to ask you about the charges Trump is facing and how his trials just keep getting delayed. But first, we have to take another quick break. We'll be right back with Jeannie Sukerson.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So As we discussed earlier, Trump is facing 37, I think, felony counts related to the classified documents that he held onto after his presidency. He's pleaded not guilty to all of the charges against him, including those ones. And that trial was supposed to begin in May, but
former President Trump is pushing to delay another federal criminal trial, this one in Florida.
This idea of Trump delaying trials, I feel like that's just all that we're seeing these days. Like, you know, Trump's facing another federal trial in D.C. for election interference, but that's also delayed because the Supreme Court is going to hear Trump's argument that he should be immune from these charges.
The Supreme Court hearing will be Trump's final shot at dismissing the case and could delay his trial indefinitely.
You have the Georgia case.
Well, Lester, this case was already unlikely to happen before the election.
I have no idea when that will go to trial. Trump is continuously trying to get the DA, Fonnie Willis, dropped from the case.
The DA now has to figure out a new lead prosecutor. Plus,
it seems like the only thing that he's likely to stand trial for at all this year is the Stormy Daniels hush money case in New York, which a lot of people honestly think is the weakest one. And even that has been pushed until at least mid-April. So I know it's not unusual for defendants to try and delay trials. And in this case, it seems like some of the delays are not solely because of Trump. But what should we make of these delays? I guess I'm wondering whether we're just kind of getting a closer look at, the legal system and how these trials actually work and how long they take, or whether Trump is kind of pulling something off here.
Both things are true. It is true that the legal system really grinds very, very slowly, even though trials are supposed to be speedy. And in fact, it's a defendant's right to have a speedy trial. In cases when there are things to be litigated, real issues to be litigated, it ends up taking a long, long time in even the normal case. But of course, in his case, in all of his cases, he has real motivation to delay them and delay them and delay them. And especially the federal cases, if he delays them, he's thinking that he will become the president of the United States. And after November, he will control the Justice Department. And as we discussed earlier, the Justice Department is ultimately answerable to the President of the United States, and potentially the people he appoints into that position will be amenable to dropping the charges and not continuing the prosecutions. And then the classified documents case and the election interference case, the special counsel cases, they will just be dropped and dismissed. And that would be the end of it if he's the president. So I think that he's making a calculation that is plausible for him for those two federal cases. If I were a betting person, I would bet that he is not brought to trial before the November election. And then if he were to win the November election, then can you really imagine having a trial between November and January when he's the president-elect? It would be really difficult to imagine a conviction happening, even if somehow a trial were to occur in that period. And then as of January, you know, he's pretty much in the clear because he can clear himself through the Justice Department just declining to pursue these cases.
Yeah, I guess one thing I'm curious about is the distinction between a president having control over his or her own Justice Department and basically being able to get charges dismissed and having like a certain kind of political control in that way versus the argument that it seems like Trump is also trying to make, which is that a sitting president can't even legally be prosecuted. Right? Isn't that part of what he's also trying to say?
Yes. The question of the immunity of the president from criminal charges is one that has been debated over time, but we've never squarely had to address it because we've never had a president who's been indicted for any crime, let alone a federal crime. So there's the question of, can a president be sued in his personal capacity for presidential conduct or non-presidential conduct? And then there's the question of criminal liability for conduct he engaged in while president and whether the behavior was related to his presidential role or unrelated to his presidential role. Like, let's say the president had murdered a random person. That's not related to his presidential role, even if he might have been the president at the time. But if the president had, ended up killing someone as part of the national security military operation that he heads, then you might say that that's part of the presidential role. So I think that there are complicated issues of civil versus criminal. And then within criminal, are these official acts or not official acts? These are all issues that are going to have to be hashed out in this case. But he's making the most sweeping argument, which is that a president or a former president is just immune from all criminal prosecution for acts taken in his presidential role. And he's saying that the January 6th conduct or the election interference conduct was something he was doing as the president of the United States in order to address election fraud. But ultimately, there's going to be a Supreme Court decision about whether he is immune from prosecution in the January 6th case.
I'm curious what you think about the immunity arguments. You know, we think about it right now, like in the context of Trump. But I mean, we were, you know, literally just talking about this Biden classified documents case. And it makes me wonder, you know, even if Her had decided, yes, you know, I'm recommending charges, you know, how far that even could have gone.
Yeah, it's a good point in that the Justice Department has a position that it has expressed, and it's not been tested in the courts, but the Justice Department's official position is that a sitting president cannot be criminally indicted or prosecuted. And so the Robert Hur report was taking for granted that Justice Department position. And so everything in it was assuming that any indictment, if it were brought, would be after his term as president, so that he would be going to trial not as the president of the United States, but after he left the office. And so that's the Justice Department's position. A sitting president cannot be criminally indicted. Now, Donald Trump is not a sitting president, and so he has been indicted multiple times, and he could be tried while he's not the president. But let's say he becomes the president while these cases are pending, then you run into the Justice Department position that a sitting president cannot be criminally prosecuted. And so I think that if the Justice Department were to stick to that position, and probably it would, then any prosecution of Donald Trump, even if he were not to dismiss the cases or order the Justice Department dismiss the cases, it would mean that he could not be criminally prosecuted while he was sitting. You'd have to kind of pause that until he finished the term, if for some reason he didn't order the Justice Department to just dismiss those cases outright.
So it seems like in Trump's case, the best thing that he could possibly do for himself is be elected president again.
That's correct. He knows that he will have all these tools at his disposal as long as the officials who he appoints to work under him are amenable to that. And interestingly enough, I think Biden, too, at this point, has an interest in being elected again, in some part because if it's the Trump Justice Department that we're dealing with next January, it's not entirely out of the question that they could revisit the classified documents case that Robert Hur just investigated. And even though Hur himself, as the special counsel, recommended no charges, a future Justice Department is not legally bound by that recommendation. I mean, it may be bound as a matter of norms and practice that it would, you know, consider that a precedent and a kind of understanding about what to do about Biden's classified documents. But I think that all bets are off in that a new Justice Department could take that report and say, well, we look at the evidence in it and we don't have the same view of what a jury would do with this evidence, because what we know is that there are recordings saying that he had classified documents, knew he had them, and then shared the material in them with a third party. So I think that there is a non-trivial chance that if Biden is not elected in November, that come the next year, there will be serious conversations about whether he will be indicted for the classified documents conduct.
Well, thank you so much, Jeannie.
Thank you.
Jeannie Sue Gerson is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and the John H. Watson Jr. Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. You can find her piece on Robert Hur at NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Stephanie Karayuki, with production assistance from James Yost and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown.